Jesper could see more pools and waterfalls, coves and alcoves, every solid surface decorated in glittering indigo tiles. Now this Jesper could get used to. Pools of steaming water, fountains dancing and burbling like guests at a party, piles of thick towels and sweet-smelling soaps. A place like this belonged in the barrel, where it could be properly appreciated, not in the middle of the financial district. They'd been told they would be meeting with only two members of the triumvirate, but three people stood by the pool. Jesper knew the one-eyed girl in the red and blue kefta must be Jinya Safin. And that meant the shockingly gorgeous girl with the thick fall of ebony hair was Zoya Najalinsky. They were accompanied by a fox-faced man in his 20s, wearing a teal frock coat, brown leather gloves, and an impressive set of Zemini revolvers slung around his hips. If these people were what Ravka had to offer, maybe Jesper should consider a visit. "We told the Grisha to come alone," said Kaz. "I'm afraid that wasn't possible," said the man. "Though Zoya is, of course, a force to be reckoned with, Jinya's extraordinary gifts are ill-suited to physical confrontation. I, on the other hand, am well-suited to all forms of confrontation, though I'm particularly fond of the physical." Kaz's eyes narrowed. "Sturmhand. He knows me," Sturmhand said delightedly. He nudged Jinya with an elbow. "I told you I'm famous." Zoya blew out an exasperated breath. "Thank you. He's going to be twice as insufferable now." "Sturmhand has been authorized to negotiate on behalf of the Ravkan throne," said Jinya.
"A pirate?"
asked Jesper.
"Privateer," Sturmhand corrected. "You can't expect the king to participate in an auction like this himself."
"Why not?"
"Because he might lose, and it looks very bad when kings lose."
Jesper couldn't quite believe he was having a conversation with the Sturmhand. The privateer was a legend. He'd broken countless blockades on behalf of the Ravkins, and there were rumors that...
"Do you really have a flying ship?" blurted Jesper.
"No."
"Oh, I have several. Take me with you."
Kaz didn't look remotely entertained. "The Ravkan king lets you negotiate for him in matters of state?" he asked skeptically.
"Occasionally," said Sturmhand.
"Especially if less than savory personages are involved.
You have a reputation, Mr. Brekker."
"So do you."
"Fair enough. So let's say we've both earned the right to have our names bandied about in the worst circles. The king won't drag Ravka into one of your schemes blindly."
"Nina's note claimed that you have Kuei Yulbo in your possession."
"I want confirmation of that fact. And I want details of your plan."
"All right," said Kaz. "Let's talk in the solarium. I'd prefer not to sweat through my suit." When the rest of them made to follow, Kaz halted and glanced over his shoulder. "Just me and the privateer." Zoya tossed her glorious black mane and said, "We are the triumvirate. We do not take orders from curt street rats with dubious haircuts."
"I can phrase it as a question if it will make your feathers lie flat," Kaz said.
"You insolent Zoya," said Sturmhand smoothly. "Let's not antagonize our new friends before they've even had a chance to cheat us.
Lead on, Mr. Brekker."
"Kaz," Weiland said, "can't you
negotiate for yourself, Merchling? It's time you learned how."
He vanished with Sturmhand back into the corridors. As their footfalls faded, silence descended. Weiland cleared his throat, and the sound bounced around the blue-tiled room like a spring colt let loose in a corral. Jinya's face was bemused.
Zoya crossed her arms. Well, ma'am, Wylan attempted. Miss Jinya? Jinya smiled, her scars tugging at the corner of her mouth.
Oh, he is sweet.
You always take to the strays, said Zoya sourly.
You're the boy Nina tailored to look like Kuwe,
Jinya said.
And you want me to try to undo her work?
Yes, Wylan said. That one word imbued with a whole world of hope.
But I don't have anything to bargain with.
Jinya rolled her single amber eye.
Why are the Kirch so focused on money?
Says the woman with a bankrupt country, murmured Jesper.
What was that?
Snapped Zoya.
Nothing, said Jesper.
Just saying, Kirch is a morally bankrupt country. Zoya looked him up and down as if she was considering tossing him into a pool and boiling him alive.
If you want to waste your time and talent on these wretches, feel free. Saints know there's room for improvement.
Zoya,
I'm going to go find a dark room with a deep pool and try to wash some of this country off.
Don't drown,
Jinya called as Zoya flounced off, then said conspiratorially,
maybe she'll do it just to be contrary.
She gave Wylan an assessing glance.
It would be difficult. If I'd known you before the changes.
Here, Wylan said eagerly.
I have a portrait. It's old, but...
She took the miniature from him.
And this,
Wylan said, offering her the poster his father had created, promising a reward for his safe return.
She said. Let's find better light.
They fumbled their way around the facilities, poking their heads into rooms full of mud baths and milk baths, and one heated chamber made entirely of jade. They finally settled in a chilly white room with a tub of odd-smelling clay against one wall and windows all along the other.
Find a chair, said Jinya, and fetch my kit from the main pool area. It's heavy. You'll find it near the towels.
You brought your kit?
Said Wylan.
The Suli girl suggested it, said Jinya, shooing them off to follow her orders.
Just as imperious as Zoya, Jesper grumbled as he and Wylan obliged.
But with better hearing, she called after them.
Jesper fetched the box from near the main pool. It was built like a small cabinet, its double doors fastened with an elaborate gold clasp. When they returned to the clay room, Jinya gestured for Wylan to sit near the window where the light was best. She rested her fingers under his chin and tilted his face this way and that. Jesper set down her kit.
What are you looking for? He asked.
The seams.
Seams?
No matter how fine a tailor's work, if you look closely, you can see the seams. The place where one thing ends and another begins. I'm looking for signs of the original structure. The portrait does help.
I don't know why I'm so nervous, said Wylan.
Because she might mess up and make you look like a weasel with curls.
Jinya lifted a flame-colored brow.
Maybe a vole.
Not funny,
said Wylan. He'd clenched his hand so tightly in his lap, his knuckles had become white stars.
All right, said Jinya. I can try, but I make no promises. Nina's work is near flawless. Luckily, so am I.
Jesper smiled.
You remind me of her. I think you mean she reminds you of me.
Jinya set to unpacking her kit. It was far more elaborate than the one Jesper had seen Nina use. There were capsules of dye, pots of colored powder, and rows of glass cases filled with what looked like clear gels.
They're cells, said Jinya. For a job like this, I need to work with human tissue.
Not disgusting at all, said Jesper.
It could be worse, she said.
I once knew a woman who rubbed whale placenta on her face in the hopes of looking younger.
to say nothing of what she did with the monkey saliva.
Human tissue sounds delightful, amended Jesper.
That's what I thought. She pushed up her sleeves, and Jesper saw that the scars on her face also traced over her hands and up her arms. He couldn't imagine what manner of weapon had twisted the tissue in that way.
You're staring, she said without facing him.
Jesper jumped, cheeks heating.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. People like to look. Well, not always. When I was first attacked, no one would look at me.
Jesper had heard she'd been tortured during the Ravkin Civil War, but that wasn't the kind of thing you made polite conversation about.
Now, I don't know where to look, he admitted.
Anywhere you like.
Just be quiet, so I don't make a hideous mess of this poor boy.
She laughed at Wyland's expression of terror.
I'm kidding. But do stay still. This is slow work, and you'll need to be patient.
She was right. The work was so slow that Jesper wasn't sure anything was happening. Jinya would place her fingertips beneath Wyland's eyes or over his lids, then step back and examine what she'd done, which, as far as Jesper could see, was nothing. Then she'd reach for one of the glass cases or bottles, dab something on her fingertips, touch Wyland's face again, step back.
Jesper's attention wandered.
He circled the room, dipped his finger in the clay, regretted it, went searching for a towel. But when he looked at Wyland from a little more distance, he could see that something had changed.
It's working, he exclaimed.
Jinya cast him a cool glance.
Of course it is.
Periodically, the tailor would stop and stretch and give Wyland a mirror so he could consult on what looked right or wrong. An hour later, Wyland's irises had gone from gold to blue, and the shape of his eyes had changed as well.
His brow should be narrower, Jesper said, peering over Jinya's shoulder.
Just a little bit, and his lashes were longer.
I didn't know you were paying attention, murmured Wyland.
Jesper grinned. I was paying attention.
Oh, good. He's blushing, said Jinya. Excellent for the circulation.
Do you train fabricators at the Little Palace? Asked Wyland.
Jesper scowled.
Why did he have to go and start that?
Of course. There's a school on the palace grounds.
What if a student were older? Said Wyland, still pushing.
A Grisha can be taught at any age. Alina Starkov didn't discover her power until she was 17 years old. And she? She was one of the most powerful Grisha who ever lived.
Jinya pushed at Wyland's left nostril.
It's easier when you're younger, but so is everything. Children learn languages more easily. They learn mathematics more easily. And they're unafraid, said Wyland quietly. It's other people who teach them their limits.
Wyland's eyes met Jesper's over Jinya's shoulder, and as if he was challenging both Jesper and himself, he said,
I can't read.
His skin went instantly blotchy, but his voice was steady. Jinya shrugged and said,
That's because no one took the time to teach you. Many of the peasants in Ravka can't read.
Lots of people took the time to teach me. They tried plenty of strategies, too. I've had every opportunity, but it's something I can't do.
Jesper could see the anxiety in his face. What it cost him to speak those words. It made him feel like a coward.
You seem to be getting along well enough, said Jinya.
Aside from your associations with street thugs and sharpshooters.
Wyland lifted his brows, and Jesper knew he was daring him to speak up. But he remained silent.
It's not a gift. It's a curse.
He walked back to the window, suddenly finding himself deeply interested in the streets below.
That's what killed your mother, do you understand?
Jinya alternated between working and having Wyland hold up the mirror to guide her through tweaks and changes. Jesper watched for a while. went upstairs to check on his father, fetched Jinya some tea and Wylan a cup of coffee. When he returned to the clay room, he nearly dropped the mugs. Wylan was sitting in the last of the afternoon light. The real Wylan. The boy he'd first seen in that tannery. The lost prince who had woken in the wrong story.
Well, Jinya said.
Wylan fiddled nervously with the buttons on his shirt.
That's him, said Jesper. That's our fresh-faced runaway merchling.
Jinya stretched and said, good. Because if I have to spend another minute smelling that clay, I may go mad. It was clear she was tired, but her face was glowing. Her amber eyes sparkled. This was the way Grisha looked when they used their power. It would be best to revisit the work anew in the morning, but I have to get back to the embassy. And by tomorrow, well, she shrugged. By tomorrow, the auction would be announced and everything would change. Wylan thanked her, and then kept on thanking her until she physically pushed them out the door so that she could go find Zoya. Jesper and Wylan took the lift back up to the suite in silence. Jesper glanced into the master bedroom and saw his father asleep atop the covers, his chest reverberating with deep snores. A pile of papers was scattered on the bed next to him. Jesper tidied them into a stack. Gerda prices. Listings of farm acreage outside cities in Novia Zim. You don't have to clean up after us, da. Someone does. Back in the sitting room, Wylan was lighting the lamps.
Are you hungry?
Famished, said Jesper. But Da's asleep. I'm not sure we're allowed to ring for food.
He cocked his head to one side, peering at Wylan.
Did you have her make you better looking?
Wylan pinked. Maybe you forgot how handsome I am. Jesper raised a brow.
Okay, maybe a little.
He joined Jesper by the window, looking out over the city. Dusk was falling, and the street lamps had bloomed in orderly formation along the edges of the canals. Patrols of Stadwatch were visible, moving through the streets, and the staves were alight with color and sound again. How long would they be safe here? Jesper wondered if the Kurgud were tracking Grisha through the city, seeking out the houses of their indentures. The Shu soldiers might be surrounding the embassy even now, or maybe this hotel. Could they smell a Grisha 15 stories up? Periodically, they could see bursts of fireworks over the staves. Jesper wasn't surprised. He understood the barrel. It was always hungry for more. Money, mayhem, violence, lust. It was a glutton. And Pekka Rollins had offered up Kaz and the rest of the crew as a feast.
I know what you were doing back there, Jesper said. You didn't have to tell her you can't read.
Wylan took the miniature of himself from his pocket and propped it on the end table. Young Wylan's serious blue eyes stared back at them.
Do you know, Kaz was the first person I ever told about my condition?
Of all the people.
I know. It felt like I'd choke on the words. I was so afraid he'd sneer at me or just laugh. But he didn't do any of that. Telling Kaz, facing my father, freed something in me. And every time I tell someone new, I feel freer.
Jesper watched the brow boat vanish beneath Zent's bridge. It was nearly empty.
I'm not ashamed of being Grisha.
Wylan ran his thumb over the edge of the miniature. He wasn't saying anything. But Jesper could tell he wanted to.
Go ahead, Jesper said. Whatever you're thinking, just say it.
Wylan looked up at him. His eyes were the clear, unspoiled blue Jesper remembered.
A high mountain lake. An endless Zemini sky.
Jinya had done her work well.
I just don't get it. I've spent my whole life hiding the things I can't do. Why run from the amazing things you can do?
Jesper gave an irritated shrug. He'd been mad at his father for almost exactly what Weiland was describing. But now, he just felt defensive. These were his choices, right or wrong, and they were long since made. I know who I am, what I'm good at, what I can and can't do. I'm what I am. A great shooter, a bad gambler. Why can't that be enough? For me or for you? Don't get philosophical on me, Merchling. Jess, I've thought about this. Thoughts of me, late at night. What was I wearing? I've thought about your powers, Weiland said, cheeks flushing pinker. Has it ever occurred to you that your Grisha ability might be part of the reason you're such a good shot? Weiland, you're cute, but you're a whole lot of crazy in one little glass. Maybe. But I've seen you manipulate metal. I've seen you direct it. What if you don't miss because you're directing your bullets, too? Jesper shook his head. This was ridiculous. He was a good shot because he'd been raised on the frontier, because he understood guns, because his mother had taught him to steady his hand, clear his mind, and to sense his target as much as see it. His mother, a fabricator, a Grisha. Even if she never used that word. No, that's not how it works. But what if it was? He shook off the thought, feeling the need to move Ignite over his skin. Why do you have to say things like that? Why can't you just let things be easy? Because they're not easy, Weiland said in his simple, earnest way. No one in the barrel talked like that. You keep pretending everything is okay. You move on to the next fight or the next party. What are you afraid is going to happen if you stop? Jesper shrugged again. He adjusted the buttons on his shirt, touched his thumbs to his revolvers. When he felt like this, mad and scattered, it was as if his hands had a life of their own. His whole body itched. He needed to get out of this room. Weiland laid his hand on Jesper's shoulder. Stop. Jesper didn't know if he wanted to jerk away or pull him closer. Just stop, Weiland said. Breathe. Weiland's gaze was steady. Jesper couldn't look away from that clear water blue. He forced himself to still. Inhaled. Exhaled. Again, Weiland said. And when Jesper opened his mouth to take another breath, Weiland leaned forward and kissed him. Jesper's mind emptied. He wasn't thinking of what had happened before or what might happen next. There was only the reality of Weiland's mouth, the press of his lips, then the fine bones of his neck, the silky feel of his curls as Jesper cupped his nape and drew him nearer. This was the kiss he'd been waiting for. It was a gunshot. It was prairie fire. It was the spin of Mocker's wheel. Jesper felt the pounding of his heart, or was it Weiland's, like a stampede in his chest, and the only thought in his head was a happy, startled, oh. Slowly, inevitably, they broke apart. Weiland, Jesper said, looking into the wide blue sky of his eyes, I really hope we don't die.
29. Nina was furious to learn that Jenya had tailored not only Weiland, but Kaz as well, and she hadn't gotten to watch. He'd let the tailor set his nose, reduce the swelling on his eye so that he could actually see, and deal with some of the worst damage he'd taken to his body. But that was all he'd permitted. Why? Said Nina. She could have...
She didn't know when to stop, said Kaz.
Nina had a sudden suspicion that Jenya had offered to heal Kaz's bad leg. Well, you look like the worst kind of barrel thug, Nina complained. You should have at least let her clean up the rest of your bruising.
I am the worst kind of barrel thug. And if I don't look like I just trounced 10 of the best toughs Per Haskell had to offer, then no one's going to believe I did. Now let's get to work. You can't throw a party if nobody gets the invitation.
Nina was not looking forward to this particular party. But the next morning, the announcement went in all the daily broadsheets, stuck to the columns at the east and west entries of the exchange, and tacked to the front door of the Stadthall. They'd kept it simple. Kuei Yulbo, son of Bo Yulbayur, chief chemist of Bezhu, makes available his service and will offer his indenture as the market and the hand of Gazan commands. Those wishing to bid are invited to participate in a free and fair auction in compliance with the laws of Kirch, the rule of the Merchant Council, and the supervision of the Council of Tides at the Church of Barter in 4 days' time. Parties will convene at noon. Sacred is Gazan, and in commerce we see his hand. The city had already been in an uproar over the curfews, barricades, and blockades. Now gossip raced through the coffee houses and taverns, changing and taking on new force from the salons of the Geldstraat all the way to the slums of the Barrel. According to Kaz's new dregs troops, people were eager for any kind of information on the mysterious Kuei Yulbo. And his auction was already being linked to the bizarre attack on West Stave that had nearly leveled 2 pleasure houses and left reports of flying men in its wake. Inej staked out the Shu embassy herself and returned with word that messengers had been coming and going all morning, and that she'd seen the ambassador himself storm down to the docks to demand the Council of Tides release one of their dry-docked ships.
"He wants to send for a fabricator so they can make gold," said Jesper.
"Pity the harbors are locked down," said Kaz.
The doors to the Stadthall were closed to the public, and the Merchant Council was said to be in an emergency meeting to determine whether they would sanction the auction. This was the test. Would they support the laws of the city? Or, given what they at least suspected about Kuei, would they falter and find some way to deny his rights? At the top of the clock tower, Nina waited with the others, watching the eastern entrance to the exchange. At noon, a man in Mercher Black approached the arch with a stack of documents. A horde of people descended on him, tearing the flyers from his hands.
"Poor little Carl Dryden," said Kaz.
Apparently, he was the most junior member of the council, so he'd been stuck with this job. Moments later, Inej burst through the door of the suite, clutching a flyer.
Incredible.
Nina had been staring straight at the crowd around Dryden and had never glimpsed her.
"They validated the auction," she said,
and handed the paper to Kaz, who passed it around the group. All the flyer said was, "In accordance with the laws of Kirch, the Merchant Council of Ketterdam agrees to act as representatives to Kuei Yulbo in the legal auction of his indenture. Sacred is Gazan, and in commerce we see his hand." Jesper blew out a long breath and looked at his father, dutifully studying commodities reports and the script Nina and Kaz had prepared for him.
"My luck, they said yes."
Inej laid a hand on his arm.
"It's not too late to change course."
"It is," said Jesper. "It was too late a long time ago."
Nina said nothing. She liked Colm. She cared about Jesper. But this auction was the best chance they had of getting Kuei to Ravka and saving Grisha lives.
"The Merchers are perfect marks," said Kaz. "They're rich and they're smart. That makes them easy to do."
"Why?" asked Wylan.
"Rich men want to believe they deserve every penny they've got, so they forget what they owe to chance. Smart men are always looking for loopholes. They want an opportunity to game the system."
"So who's the hardest mark to swindle?" asked Nina.
"The toughest mark is an honest one," said Kaz. "Thankfully, they're always in short supply."
He tapped the glass of the clock face, gesturing to Carl Dryden, who was still standing by the exchange, fanning himself with his hat now that the crowd had dispersed.
"Dryden inherited his fortune from his father. Since then, he's been too timid an investor to substantially add to his wealth. He's desperate for a chance to prove himself to the other members of the Merchant Council. We're going to give him one."
"What else do we know about him?" asked Nina. Kaz almost smiled.
"We know he's represented by our good friend and dog lover, Cornelis Smeet."
From their earlier surveillance of Cornelis Smeet's office, They knew the attorney had runners taking documents back and forth to clients all day long, gathering necessary signatures and conveying important information. The messengers were too well paid to consider bribing, especially if one of them turned out to be among those few dreaded honest men. And in a way, they had Van Eck to thank for the ease with which Kaz baited the trap. Dressed in Stodwatch uniforms, Annika and Pim stopped Smeet's messengers with impunity, demanding to see their identification while their bags were searched. The documents inside were confidential and sealed. But they weren't after the documents. They just needed to plant a few crumbs to entice young Carl Dryden. "Sometimes," said Kaz, "a prepper thief doesn't just take. He leaves something behind." Working with Spect, Weiland had created a stamp that could be pressed to the back of a sealed envelope. It gave the impression that the envelope had absorbed the ink from another document, as if some thoughtless clerk had left the papers somewhere damp. When the messengers delivered Dryden's files, if he was curious at all, he'd at least glance at the words that seemed to have leached onto his packet of papers. And he'd find something very interesting indeed. A letter from one of Smeet's other clients. The client's name was unreadable, but the letter was clearly an inquiry. Did Smeet have knowledge of a farmer named Johannes Rietveld, the head of a consortium of Kirch and Zemini Gerda growers? He was taking meetings at the Geldrenner Hotel with select investors only. Would an introduction be possible? Prior to the announcement of Kuwait's auction, the information would have been of mild interest. Afterward, it was the kind of tip that could make fortunes. Even before they'd baited the trap with the false letter, Kaz had Colm taking meals in the Geldrenner's lavish purple dining room, with various members of Kirch's trade and banking community. Colm always sat at a good distance away from any other customers, ordered extravagantly, and spoke with his guests in hushed tones. The content of the discussions was completely benign, talk of crop reports and interest rates. But no one in the dining room knew that. Everything was done in conspicuous view of the hotel staff, so that when members of the merchant council came asking about how Mr. Rietveld spent his time, they got the answers that Kaz wanted them to. Nina was present at all these meetings, playing the role of Mr. Rietveld's multilingual assistant, a Grisha Heartrender seeking work after the destruction of the House of the White Rose. Despite dousing herself in coffee extract to mislead the senses of the Caregood, she felt exposed just sitting out in the open in the dining room. Kaz had members of the dregs constantly watching the streets around the hotel for signs of the shoe soldiers. No one had forgotten that they were hunting Grisha, and that Nina might present a very appealing target if they found out about the meetings. Acquiring a Heartrender they could dose with Perem would mean they could radically alter the course of the auction, and might be well worth antagonizing the Council of Tides. Still, Nina felt pretty confident that the merchers who learned of Rietveld's presence at the hotel would be keeping quiet. Kaz had educated her well on the power of greed, and these men wanted every bit of profit for themselves. Nina also appreciated the attention Kaz had paid to Colm's appearance. He was still dressed as a farmer, but Kaz had made a few subtle improvements. A finer coat, polished boots, a silver tie pin set with a small chunk of raw amethyst. These were the signs of prosperity that the merchers would notice and appreciate. Nothing too gaudy or loud, nothing that might provoke suspicion. Merchers were like most men. They wanted to believe they were the ones doing the courting. As for Nina, Jenya had offered up a glorious red kefta from her collection, and they'd pulled out the embroidery, altering it from blue to black. She and Jenya were hardly the same size, but they'd managed to let out the seams and sew in a few extra panels. It had felt strange to wear a proper kefta after so long. The one Nina had worn at the House of the White Rose had been a costume. Cheap finery meant to impress their clientele. This was the real thing, worn by soldiers of the Second Army, made of raw silk dyed in a red only a fabricator could create. Did she even have a right to wear such a thing now? When Matthias had seen her, he'd frozen in the doorway of the suite, his blue eyes shocked. They'd stood there in silence until he'd finally said,
You look very beautiful.
You mean I look like the enemy?
Both of those things have always been true.
And he'd simply offered her his arm. Nina had been nervous about Colm taking the lead role in this charade. He was most definitely an amateur, and during their first few meetings with bankers and consultants, he'd looked nearly as green as his pea soup. But with every passing hour, his confidence had grown, and Nina had begun to feel the stirrings of hope. And yet, no member of the Merchant Council had come to see Johannes Rietveld. Maybe Dryden had never seen the trace of the fake document, or had decided not to act on it. Or maybe Kaz had just overestimated his greed. Then, only 48 hours before the auction, Johannes Rietveld received a note from Carl Dryden, announcing that he would call on Mr. Rietveld that day, and hoped to discuss matters of business that might be profitable to them both. Jesper tried to calm his father's nerves while Kaz dispatched instructions to Annika and Pym. If they wanted to hook Dryden, they'd need to make sure other bigger fish were interested in the bait. Nina and Colm had gone through their morning meetings in the dining room as usual, and she'd done her best to try to calm him. At 11 bells, she spotted two men in staid Mercher black entering the dining room. They didn't pause to ask the host where to find Johannes Rietveld, but walked directly to his table, a sure sign they'd been watching him and gathering information.
"They're here,"
she whispered to Colm, then instantly regretted it when he sat up straighter and started to turn in his seat. She grabbed his hand.
"Look at me," she said. "Ask me about the weather."
"Why the weather?"
he said, sweat beating on his brow.
"Well, you could ask me about the latest fashion in footwear if you prefer. I'm just trying to get you to act natural."
She was attempting to steady her own heart rate, something she used to be able to do without ridiculous attempts at deep breathing, because she'd recognized the man with Dryden. It was Jan Van Eck. The men approached the table, then removed their hats.
"Mr. Rietveld."
"Yes?"
Colm squeaked. Not an auspicious beginning. Nina gave him the gentlest kick she could manage beneath the table. He coughed.
"What business, gentlemen?"
During their preparations, Kaz had insisted that Nina learn all the Merchant Council's house colors and symbols, and Nina recognized their tie pins. A golden wheat sheaf bound with a blue enamel ribbon for the Dryden family, and the red laurel for Van Eck. Even without the pin, she would have recognized Jan Van Eck's resemblance to Wylan. She eyed his receding hairline. Poor Wylan might have to invest in a good tonic. Dryden cleared his throat importantly.
"I am Carl Dryden, and this is the esteemed Jan Van Eck."
"Mr. Dryden,"
Colm said, his surprise a bit overblown.
"I received your note. Unfortunately, my day is fully booked."
"I wonder if we might secure just a few minutes of conversation."
"We have no wish to waste your time, Mr. Rietveld,"
said Van Eck with a surprisingly charming smile.
"Or ours."
"Very well,"
Jesper's father said, projecting reluctance rather convincingly.
"Please, join us."
"Thank you,"
Van Eck said with another smile.
"We understand you represent a consortium of Gerda farmers."
Colm looked around, as if concerned that someone might overhear.
"It's possible I do. How do you come by this information?"
"I'm afraid that's not within my power to disclose."
"He's hiding something," said Nina.
Dryden and Van Eck frowned in unison.
"I learned from the captain of the ship you traveled on," said Van Eck.
"He's lying," said Nina.
"How could you possibly know that?"
Dryden asked irritably.
"I am Grisha," Nina said with a dramatic wave. "No secret is beyond my grasp."
She might as well enjoy herself. Dryden's lower lip disappeared as he sucked on it nervously, and Van Eck said grudgingly,
"It's possible some sensitive information may have made its way into our hands through Cornelis Smeet's office."
"I see,"
said Colm, looking very grim indeed. Nina wanted to applaud. Now the Merchers were on the defensive.
"We are interested in the possibility of adding to your list of investors,"
said Vanek. I don't need more investors.
How can that be? Asked Dryden. You've been in the city less than a week.
The climate has changed somehow. I don't completely understand it, but there's been a run on Jurda.
Now Vanek leaned forward, eyes slightly narrowed.
That is interesting, Mr. Rietveld. How is it that you appeared in Ketterdam at such a fortuitous time? Why choose now to start a Jurda consortium?
So much for the defensive. But Kaz had prepared Colm for this. If you must know. A few months ago, someone began buying up Jurda farms surrounding Coughton. But no one could discover his identity. Some of us realized something must be brewing. So we chose not to sell to him. And instead started our own enterprise.
An unknown buyer? Asked Dryden curiously. Vanek looked a bit ill.
Yes, said Nina. Mr. Rietveld and his partners had no success in learning who he might be, but perhaps you gentlemen might have better luck. There's talk that he's Kurt.
Vanek sank back in his seat. His pale skin had acquired a clammy sheen. The power at the table had shifted once again. The last thing Vanek wanted was anyone looking into who had been buying up those Jurda fields. Nina gave Colm another gentle nudge. The less interested they seemed in the council's money, the more eager the council members would be to give it up.
Actually, continued Colm, if you suss him out, you might be able to go in on his scheme instead. He may still be seeking investors.
No, said Vanek a bit too sharply. After all, you are here now and able to represent our interests. Why waste time and effort in pointless sleuthing? Each man has the right to seek profit where he finds it.
All the same, said Dryden. It's possible this investor knew something about the situation with the shoe.
Vanek cast Dryden a warning look. He clearly didn't want council business spread around so casually.
The young merc shut his mouth with a snap. But then Vanek pressed his fingers together and said,
It's certainly worth gathering all the information we can. I will take it upon myself to investigate this other buyer.
Then perhaps we needn't move quite so soon, said Dryden.
Timid indeed, thought Nina.
She glimpsed Annika's signal from across the lobby.
Mr. Rietveld, your next appointment?
She cast a meaningful glance at the lobby, where Roddy, looking marvelously dapper in Mercher black, led a group of men through the entry and past the dining room.
Vanek and Dryden exchanged a glance. At the sight of Yellen Rodmacher, one of the wealthiest investors in all of Kirch, walking through the lobby. In fact, as soon as Dryden's note had arrived requesting a meeting, several investors had been invited to a presentation on Zemini oil futures that had nothing to do with the fictional Johannes Rietveld. Of course, Vanek and Dryden didn't know that. The important thing was they believed they might lose their opportunity to invest. Nina was almost sorry she wouldn't get a chance to hear Jesper hold forth on the resources market for an hour. Nina gave Colm another kick under the table.
Well, he said hurriedly.
I must be on my way, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure.
What's the stake price? Asked Dryden.
I'm afraid at this late date, I couldn't really take on more...
What if we came in together?
Vanek said.
Together? The Merchant Council believes Jurda prices may change soon. Until recently, our hands were bound by our roles as public servants, but the upcoming auction has freed us to pursue new investments.
Is that legal?
Colm asked, his brow furrowing with every appearance of deepest concern.
Absolutely. We are prohibited from influencing the outcome of the auction, but an investment in your fund is well within the law. And could be mutually beneficial to us both.
I see how the fund may benefit you, but...
You've been courting separate investors. What if the Merchant Council became your lead investors? What if this became our fund exclusively? The Council represents 13 of the oldest and most established families in Kirch, with thriving businesses and plenty of capital. The farmers in your consortium could have no better partners.
I...
I don't know, said Calm. That's certainly appealing, but I would need serious security if we were to expose ourselves to risk in this way. If the Council were to back out, we'd lose all our investors at once, Dryden bristled.
No member of the Merchant Council would violate a contract. We'll enter into it with our own seals, and have it witnessed by the judge of your choosing.
Nina could almost see the wheels turning in Vanek's mind. No doubt there had been farmers who refused to sell in Novuzem. Now he had the chance to control not only the Jurta fields he'd purchased, but a good chunk of those he'd failed to acquire as well. Nina also wondered if, given the money the search for his son was costing the city, he was feeling pressure to bring the Council a good opportunity.
Give us 48 hours to...
began Vanek. Colm's expression was apologetic.
I'm afraid I must finish my business here by tomorrow night. I've already booked passage.
The harbors are closed, said Vanek. You're not going anywhere.
Jesper's father directed a cold gray glare at Vanek that raised the hair on Nina's arms.
I feel distinctly bullied, Mr. Vanek, and I don't like it.
For a moment, Vanek held his gaze. Then his greed got the better of him.
24 hours, then, said Vanek.
Colm pretended to hesitate.
24 hours. But I make no promises. I must do what's best for the consortium.
Of course,
Vanek said, as they rose and shook hands.
We only ask that you make no final decision until we've had a chance to make our case for taking over the fund. I think you'll find our offer very generous.
Colm glanced in the direction that Rodmacher had gone.
I suppose I can do that. Good day, gentlemen.
As Nina turned to follow him out of the dining room, Vanek said,
Mrs. Enek?
Yes?
I hear you worked out of the House of the White Rose.
His lips curled slightly, as if even saying the name of a brothel constituted debauchery.
I did.
I'd heard the Heartrender there occasionally works with Kaz Brekker.
I've done jobs for Brekker before,
Nina conceded easily. Best to go on the offense. She took Vanek's hand in hers, delighted at the way his whole body seemed to recoil.
But please believe me. If I had any idea where he's taken your son, I would tell the authorities.
Vanek stiffened. Clearly he hadn't intended to take the conversation in that direction.
I... thank you.
I can't even imagine the anguish you must be going through. How did Brekker even lay hands on the boy?
Nina continued.
I would have thought your security...
Wylan wasn't at home.
No?
He was studying music in Belent.
And what do his teachers have to say about the abduction?
I...
Vanek looked uneasily at Dryden.
They are flummoxed as well.
Perhaps he fell in with bad company?
Perhaps.
I hope he didn't cross Kaz Brekker, Nina said with a shudder.
Wylan wouldn't...
Of course not, said Nina,
as she shook out the cuffs of her kefta and prepared to exit the dining room.
Only a fool would.
30. Kaz. Nina was tired. Kaz could see it. They all were. Even he'd had no choice but to rest after the fight. His body had stopped listening to him. He'd passed an invisible limit and simply shut down. He didn't remember falling asleep. He didn't dream. One moment he was resting in the sweet, smallest bedroom on his back, running through the particulars of the plan, and the next he was waking in the dark, panicked, unsure of where he was or how he'd gotten there. When he reached to turn up the lamp, he felt a sharp twinge of pain. It had been excruciating to endure Jenya's faint touches when she'd seen to his injuries. But maybe he should have let the tailor heal him just a little bit more. He still had a long night ahead of him, and the auction scheme was unlike anything he'd attempted. In his time with the dregs, Kaz had seen and heard plenty, but his conversation with Sturmhand in the Solarium had topped it all. They had talked through the details of the auction, what they would need from Jenya, how Kaz predicted the betting would go, and in what increments. Kaz wanted Sturmhan to enter the fray at 50 million and suspected the shoe would counter by raising 10 million or more. Kaz needed to know the Ravkins were committed. Once the auction was announced, it would have to proceed. There could be no backward step. The privateer was wary, pressing for knowledge on how they'd been hired on for the ice court job, as well as how they'd managed to find and liberate Kuwei. Kaz gave him enough information to convince the privateer that Kuwei was in fact Bo Yul Bayor's son, but he had no interest in divulging the mechanics of their schemes or the true talents of his crew. For all Kaz knew, Sturmhan might have something he wanted to steal one day. At last, Sturmhan straightened the lapels of his teal frock coat and said, "Well, Brekker, it's obvious you only deal in half-truths and outright lies, so you're clearly the man for the job." "There's just one thing," said Kaz, studying the privateer's broken nose and ruddy hair. "Before we join hands and jump off a cliff together, I want to know exactly who I'm running with." Sturmhan lifted a brow. "We haven't been on a road trip or exchanged clothes, but I think our introductions were civilized enough. Who are you really, privateer? Is this an existential question? No proper thief talks the way you do." "How narrow-minded of you. I know the look of a rich man's son, and I don't believe a king would send an ordinary privateer to handle business this sensitive." "Ordinary?" scoffed Sturmhan. "Are you so schooled in politics?" "I know my way around a deal. Who are you? We get the truth or my crew walks." "Are you so sure that would be possible, Brekker? I know your plans now. I'm accompanied by two of the world's most legendary Grisha, and I'm not too bad in a fight either. And I'm the canal rat who brought Kuwei Yul Bo out of the ice court alive. Let me know how you like your chances." His crew didn't have clothes or titles to rival the Ravkins, but Kaz knew where he'd put his money if he had any left. Sturmhan clasped his hands behind his back, and Kaz saw the barest shift in his demeanor. His eyes lost their bemused gleam and took on a surprising weight. No ordinary privateer at all. "Let us say," said Sturmhan, gaze trained on the Ketterdam street below, "hypothetically, of course, that the Ravkin King has intelligence networks that reach deep within Kerch, Firda, and the Shu Han, and that he knows exactly how important Kuwei Yul Bo could be to the future of his country. Let us say that King would trust no one to negotiate such matters but himself, but that he also knows just how dangerous it is to travel under his own name when his country is in turmoil, when he has no heir, and the Lansov succession is in no way secured. So, hypothetically," Kaz said, "you might be addressed as Your Highness, and a variety of more colorful names. Hypothetically." The privateer cast him an assessing glance. "Just how did you know I wasn't who I claimed to be, Mr. Brekker?" Kaz shrugged. "You speak Kerch like a native, a rich native. You don't talk like someone who came up with sailors and street thugs." The privateer turned slightly, giving Kaz his full attention. His ease was gone, and now he looked like a man who might command armies. "Mr. Brekker," he said. "Kaz, if I may, I am in a vulnerable position. I am a king ruling a country with an empty treasury, facing enemies on all sides. There are also forces within my country that might seize any absence as an opportunity to make their own bid for power. So you're saying you'd make an excellent hostage? I suspect that the ransom for me would be considerably less than the price Kuwei has on his head. Really, it's a bit of a blow to my self-esteem." "You don't seem to be suffering," said Kaz. "Sturmhan was a creation of my youth, and his reputation still serves me well. I cannot bid on Kuwei Yul Bo as the king of Ravka. I hope your plan will play out the way you think it will. But if it doesn't, the loss of such a prize would be seen as a humiliating blunder, diplomatically and strategically. I enter that auction as Sturmhan or as no one at all. If that is a problem," Kaz settled his hands on his cane, "as long as you don't try to con me, you can enter as the Fairy Queen of Istamir. It's certainly nice to have my options open." He looked back out at the city. "Can this possibly work, Mr. Brekker? or am I risking the fate of Ravka and the world's Grisha on the honor and abilities of a fast-talking urchin? More than a bit of both, said Kaz. You're risking a country. We're risking our lives. Seems a fair trade. The king of Ravka offered his hand. The deal is the deal? The deal is the deal. They shook. Huh. If only treaties could be signed so quickly, he said. His easy privateer's mien sliding back in place like a mask purchased on West Stave. I'm going to have a drink and a bath. One can only take so much mud and squalor. As the rebel said to the prince, it's bad for the constitution. He flicked an invisible speck of dust from his lapel and sauntered out of the solarium. Now Kaz smoothed his hair and pulled on his jacket. It was hard to believe a lowly canal rat had struck a deal with a king. He thought of that broken nose that gave the privateer the look of someone who had been through a fair share of fistfights. For all Kaz knew, he had. But he must have been tailored to disguise his features. Hard to lie low when your face was on the money. In the end, royalty or not, Sturmhand was really just a very grand con man. And all that mattered was that he and his people did their part. Kaz checked his watch. Past midnight. Later than he would have liked. And went to find Nina. He was surprised to see Jesper waiting in the hall. What is it? Kaz said, his mind instantly trying to calculate all the things that might have gone wrong as he slept. Nothing, Jesper said. Or no more than usual. Then what do you want? Jesper swallowed and said, Matthias gave you the remaining Perem, didn't he? So? If anything happens, the shoe will be at the auction, maybe the Caregood. There's too much riding on this job. I can't let my father down again. I need the Perem, as a security measure. Kaz studied him for a long moment. No. Why the hell not? A reasonable question. Giving Jesper the Perem would have been the smart move, the practical move. Your father cares more about you than some plot of land. But I'm not going to let you make yourself a martyr, Jess. If one of us goes down, we all go down. This is my choice to make, and yet I seem to be the one making it. Kaz headed toward the sitting room. He didn't intend to argue with Jesper, especially wasn't entirely sure why he was saying no in the first place. Who's Geordi? Kaz paused. He'd known the question would come, and yet it was still hard to hear his brother's name spoken. Someone I trusted. He looked over his shoulder and met Jesper's gray eyes. Someone I didn't want to lose. Kaz found Nina and Matthias asleep on the couch in the purple sitting room. Why the two biggest people in their crew had chosen the smallest space to sleep on, he had no idea. He gave Nina a nudge with his cane. Without opening her eyes, she tried to bat it away. Rise and shine. Go away, she said, burying her head in Matthias's chest. Let's go, Zenik. The dead will wait, but I won't. At last she roused herself and pulled on her boots. She had discarded her red kefta in favor of the coat and trousers she'd worn during the disastrous botch that had been the sweet reef job. Matthias watched her every move, but he did not ask to accompany them. He knew his presence would only increase their risk of exposure. Inej appeared in the doorway, and they headed for the lift in silence. Curfew was in effect on the streets of Ketterdam, but there was no avoiding this. They would have to rely on luck and Inej's ability to scout the path ahead of them for patrolling Stadwatch. They left the back of the hotel and headed toward the manufacturing district. Their progress was slow. A circuitous route around the blockade, full of stops and starts as Inej vanished and reappeared, signaling them to wait or rerouting them with a flick of her hand before she was gone once more. At last they reached the morgue, an unmarked gray stone structure on the border of the warehouse district, fronted by a guard and no one had tended to in some time. Only the bodies of the wealthy were brought here to be prepared for transportation and burial outside the city. It wasn't the miserable human heap of the Reaper's barge. But Kaz still felt like he was descending into a nightmare. He thought of Inez's voice echoing off the white tiles. Go on. The morgue was deserted, its heavy iron door sealed tight. He picked the lock and looked once over his shoulder at the shifting shadows of the weedy garden. He couldn't see Inej, but he knew she was there. She would keep watch over the entrance as they got this grim business done. It was chilly inside, lit only by a lantern with the blue-tinted warning flame of corpse light. There was a processing room, and beyond it, a large, icy stone chamber lined with drawers.